Welcome to the Confluence Investment Management Biweekly Geopolitical Report for March 11th, 2024. I'm Phil Adler. Could the defense industry at some point challenge technology for stock market leadership? Confluence Associate Market Strategist Daniel Ortworth and Chief Market Strategist Patrick Fearon-Hernandez join us today to discuss why the rebirth of U.S. nuclear deterrence policy appears to be a game changer on many levels. Patrick, we've already discussed this issue recently. Why is it important to return to it today?
Well, hi, Phil. Thanks for having both Dan and myself on the program. You know, we see this article as kind of a companion piece to the discussion we had on deterrence a couple of weeks ago. Against the backdrop of ever-increasing geopolitical tensions and great power competition, the deterrence article examined deterrence as a strategy and discussed how nuclear weapons are the gold standard of deterrence, which more and more countries are likely to rely on in the coming years. Now, this new article, which was primarily written by Dan Ortworth, it focuses specifically on the U.S. nuclear enterprise, or the U.S. nuclear deterrent, and provides an update on how it's being modernized. And of course, the article also gives us an opportunity to dive deeper into the investment implications of modernized and expanded nuclear forces around the world.
Daniel, listeners might get the impression that rebirth is something that's just getting underway now. How long has what you call the U.S. nuclear deterrence revolution been underway?
Believe it or not, Phil, the revolution began 15 years ago in 2009. Now, to most listeners, this might seem out of step with their memories. 15 years ago, Barack Obama had just become president, and in his first foreign policy speech, that May in Prague, he shared a vision for a world completely free of nuclear weapons. He laid out a plan for further nuclear arms reduction for the U.S. and Russia, while also giving new emphasis to non-proliferation efforts as steps toward that vision. This is what got all of the press at the time. However, at the same time as these pronouncements, the President and Congress were commissioning a thorough review of our nuclear forces in the context of the national security landscape of that time. The conclusions of that review did not get nearly the coverage of the nuclear-free vision, but they drove the policy decisions that started the revolution. In short, and remember, Phil, these were conclusions reached in 2010 once that review was complete. The world is still a dangerous place, the U.S. still needs a strong deterrent, and the nation had neglected its deterrent enterprise for far too long, really since the end of the Cold War in 1991, while focusing on counterterrorism operations in the wake of 9/11. U.S. leadership responded to these conclusions by initiating a 30-year, $1 trillion modernization program addressing every aspect of the enterprise. This program has enjoyed consistent bipartisan support ever since.
Still, it wasn't so long ago that the U.S. officially viewed Russia and China as basically non-threatening. Why did we get it so wrong?
I'll tell you, Phil, that question has inspired considerable debate, but two main explanations have emerged from the noise. Firstly, after the Cold War, U.S. leadership chose to embark on a policy of constructive engagement toward these two countries. The idea was to embrace them as new members of the global community with the expectation that as they increasingly benefited from participation in the global system, they would come to see how their long-term interests align with the broader community. Many considered this approach to be the reason that after World War II, Germany and Japan transformed from enemies to core members of the post-war order. We are now seeing increasing evidence that Russia and China have a different agenda in mind and that our policy of engagement has failed. Now, secondly, ever since 9/11, only until recently really, American strategy has focused on fighting the terrorist threat. That's understandable when you consider how traumatic 9/11 was, but it was probably a mistake. We are awakening to a realization that by focusing our military efforts on something that traumatized us but didn't really existentially threaten our long-term security, we took our collective eye off the eight ball.
Well, let's discuss progress in each of the three operational elements comprising the U.S. nuclear deterrence enterprise. First, land-based intercontinental missiles, or ICBMs.
I think it will help us to start by addressing a common thread that unites all three of the main elements that we're going to discuss. Each component of the current U.S. nuclear enterprise dates to before the end of the Cold War. We have performed some helpful updates to these systems, but that's it. This means that today the core technologies inside of these systems are at best 40 years old and oftentimes older than that. Now, extension of this common thread is the realization within U.S. leadership that updates and life extensions to old systems simply will not cut it anymore. There comes a point at which you need to replace the core system. Think about how you might try to hold on to your current smartphone just as long as you can, making update after update, trying to make it last, and put off that day. But there comes a point at which that just doesn't work anymore. It might be expensive, but you just have to bite the bullet and buy the new phone. That is the decision we have made across the nuclear enterprise. The Minuteman III, that's our current ICBM, might be the best example of this because it is the oldest of our nuclear weapon systems, having first come online in 1970, and it is the hardest to replace. Each missile has its own manned control station deep underground, and they are located across a broad range of land, often many miles away from the central command base. Some of the communication linkages in this network are about as old as a rotary phone, if you remember what that is. So the new ICBM, called the Sentinel, is not just a new missile. It is an entire network of systems and structures that are getting replaced.
How about submarine-based missiles?
The critical element of this part of the enterprise is the submarine itself. It needs to be so quiet and durable that it can cruise for months on end throughout the vastness of the oceans without any chance of being detected anywhere it goes, and to be able to stay at sea for months on end. The new Columbia class of nuclear missile submarine will begin to enter service later this decade, replacing the Ohio class, whose design dates to the 80s. The key here is the ability to stay several steps ahead of the ever-improving sensor technologies employed by a prospective enemy. Detection capabilities have gotten a lot better since the 80s, so we need to move forward. Now, with these submarines, the big challenge is construction capacity. The U.S. simply does not have the shipbuilding resources it once had. This has to be restored, and it will be a real challenge to complete more than one of these submarines per year. It will probably be quite a while before most of the Columbia class enters service.
And finally, how are we improving our capability to strike from the air?
This is the new system that most reminds me of the smartphone upgrade. The current state-of-the-art bomber is the B-2 Spirit, which entered service in 1992. I think by now most of us are familiar with its appearance, a sort of black-painted flying wing. Well, the replacement, the B-21 Raider, looks just like it. It's really hard to tell one from the other. You know how when you finally bite the bullet and buy the new phone, it might look exactly like the old one until you activate it and start using it, and you feel like you've come out of the dark ages. The basic design of the B-21 shares a lot in common with the B-2, but once you get into it, well, there's a reason the nation is committing to this expensive but worthwhile upgrade.
Daniel, in the past, the U.S. has tended to focus on one enemy, not several. How have today's geopolitics multiplied the commitment we need to succeed?
Bill, that's a pretty key concept right there. During the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were the only two major nuclear powers. There were other smaller nuclear powers, such as the U.K. and France, but their arsenals were far smaller. They were not trying to compete with the U.S., and they tended to be friendly or neutral. So long as the two great powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, maintained a rough level of parity, aided by a healthy flow of communication, the balance of power was relatively stable. Now that we are dealing with three major nuclear powers, two of which, China and Russia, are at odds with the other, the U.S., there is no sense of stability, and new difficult questions arise. Does the U.S. need to develop an arsenal large enough to deter both Russia and China simultaneously? Will this inspire each of them to try to match the U.S., sparking an unprecedented arms race? Does the U.S. even have the resources for that kind of effort? Will Russia and China stay on friendly terms with each other? This is largely forgotten, but they actually fought a border war with each other during the Cold War. Questions such as this abound, and leadership is still wrestling with how to best approach the emerging challenge.
Recently, the American public was, I think it was fair to say, startled by the disclosure that Russia is developing a nuclear weapon to use in space against satellites. Is the U.S. populace sufficiently alarmed, do you think, to favor an increase in funding at the dramatic level needed to compete?
Phil, we really don't know the answer to that question yet, and I think we are in only the beginning stage of the national conversation. Here at Confluence, we have observed what seems to be a growing reluctance on the part of the U.S. citizenry for its country to continue in the global leadership role that it has played since the end of World War II. Will this disclosure that you just mentioned be perceived as enough of a threat to the U.S. to change the course of thought among so many average citizens? At this point, the jury is out. At Confluence, we definitely view these kinds of developments as serious. People need to be informed, and we are doing the best we can to present the facts as we know them in a balanced manner, neither casually nor with too much alarm. Let's get a handle on the facts so that we can make informed decisions as both citizens and investors.
Well, let's look at the investment implications of this nuclear deterrence revolution. In my introduction, I compared technology and defense as attractive locations for investment dollars. But I imagine there is a merger here that both will benefit from a trend that seems to have tremendous lasting strength.
Phil, I'll jump in here and take this one. Yeah, you're right. The nuclear enterprise and its modernization bring together developments in both technology and defense. It's a great example of how modern defense forces are highly technological and incorporate everything from advanced information processing and semiconductors and software to advanced materials and aerospace breakthroughs. Today's defense industry isn't just metal benders making ships and tanks. As global defense spending rises, a lot of technology companies could see rising revenues and profits if they have enough defense business.
Patrick, I was interested to read recently that because the U.S. cannot sufficiently produce right now the amount of weaponry needed to fight today's global battles, we're calling on allies to help out with production, with Australia, one of those countries, stepping up to the plate. Do you identify this as a trend that might influence your view of any foreign markets?
Yes, and that gets to the idea of foreign defense firms or other types of foreign companies that do or will have a lot of defense business. In fact, in 2023, foreign defense stocks actually outperformed U.S. defense stocks. The U.S. defense industry and defense-related stocks continue to face fiscal uncertainties, like Congress's constant continuing resolutions instead of longer-term budgets. For investors, we think you have to keep an eye open for foreign defense and related opportunities as well. We think there will be a continuing plethora of good opportunities there.
As you look at today's markets, do you think it's time to take some AI-related technology dollars off the table and reinvest elsewhere with a greater emphasis on defense?
Well, we do think there's a lot of froth in the prices of the AI-related leaders and in large cap growth stocks in general. That argues for channeling at least new money, let's say, into value-oriented sectors like broad industrials and defense. Nevertheless, we are intrigued by the likely opportunities in AI. The technology really could be revolutionary, and so it's not crazy to have some exposure to it, especially given that a lot of leading companies are big, well-established firms with good profitability and cash flows.
Finally, you identify uranium and uranium miners as an investment opportunity, and Confluence has already acted on that. How has that worked out?
Yeah, last October in Confluence's asset allocation portfolios, we added an exchange-traded fund focused on uranium and uranium miners to our mid-cap exposures. So far, that position has performed very strongly, which is what you would expect given that spot uranium prices have soared in recent months. And to relate the uranium investment to the article we're discussing here today, I would note that we're putting a lot of work in trying to gauge just how much incremental uranium demand might arise as countries modernize, expand, or adopt nuclear weapons going forward. Our preliminary work suggests the additional demand could be substantial, which suggests the prospects for uranium and uranium miners should remain positive going forward.
Of course, uranium also benefits from a global drive toward nuclear energy. How do you go about exactly identifying where best to allocate investment dollars within this uranium family?
Well, Phil, in our asset allocation portfolios, we focus on ETFs, and they're typically going to provide exposure to multiple names, as is the case with the one we bought in October. Right now, we also have exposure to individual uranium miners in our hard assets portfolio, which invests in a range of companies focused on natural resources. In that portfolio, we use the typical Confluence discipline that focuses on high-quality companies and buying at a reasonable price. Between those two approaches, we think we can find good ways to take advantage of the prospects that we see in uranium going forward.
Thank you, Patrick and Daniel. Our discussion today is based upon sources and data believed to be accurate and reliable. Opinions and forward-looking statements expressed are subject to change without notice, and this information does not constitute a solicitation or an offer to buy or sell any security. Our audio engineer is Dane Stoll. I'm Phil Adler.